mainly the idea is to kind of play with the code that's there and experiment with the algorithm and try calling it with different parameters and plotting the results and just kind of thinking about how everything works. So can I just take a quick poll? How far did people get in the notebook from last time? Did you get like halfway finished, or all the way finished, or not really anywhere? not really anywhere? Okay. All right, so so basically on the I'm gonna plug in for a sec and just project a bit of stuff. Whoops. Okay, so okay, this is from last time. This is the one that's called Lecture 3 - completed. Last time was Lecture 3, this time is Lab 3. I don't know. The naming scheme is maybe not that good. But they're covering pretty similar things. So in this one, in Lecture 3 from last time, basically we did it goes through the fitting a straight line, but the simple one without the foreground background modeling, and compares Markov chain Monte Carlo results to the like least squares solution that you can write down and compute with linear algebra. And the idea there was to get you to experiment with the MCMC algorithm and to play with the results where the results are in two dimensions, so you can actually look at them and play with them. And then what I was hoping to do today was to extend that to our foreground background model that has five parameters, so that it, so that you can kind of extend that intuition and see how the sampler works in a more interesting space of problems. So, I guess so. I think what I'll do maybe is just talk through some of the results and things from last time, and you can pay attention if you're interested, or tune out and work on today's, or tune out and work on later on in this one from last time, as you please. And if you have questions that you, with whatever you're working on, feel free to raise your hand and I'll try to come and help. All right, so what's on screen just now is, I'm gonna hide the header, hide the toolbar. Is a run of the MCMC algorithm from last time on the straight line model, and just taking 1,000 steps. And if we plot the where that particle moves in the space, we can see that we started out in some kind of initialization that we chose in the parameter space, and it fairly quickly walks uphill and finds the peak of the main kind of body of the probability, and then over, as time goes on, proceeds to sort of walk across that parameter space. So you see this kind of behavior where it's kind of oscillating and walking from side to side, walking around that space. And we saw yesterday that because we're doing this series of steps, the samples in the chain are correlated. You can sort of see that there's some kind of correlation length here in the samples. So effectively, even though we took 1,000 steps, we don't get 1,000 independent samples. We get a much smaller number. It's kind of, effectively the number of samples divided by the correlation length. And in practice, it's really common to throw away the first, some kind of eyeballed number of initial samples that are called the burn-in. And that's kind of just the phase when you expect it to be finding the main body of the distribution and sort of starting to sample properly. And you know, you can sort of see that these aren't following the same distribution as these. So, and if I were looking at these, I would say, oh yeah, after 500, let's throw them away. And these simulations happen to run extremely quickly, so there's no problem running a million. But in practice, you know, as the computations get more expensive or the state spaces get bigger, always end up being faced with the problem of how many samples do I have to run? Are we converged yet? Can I get away with keeping only throwing away the first 200 as burn-in, and so on? It's always filled with these compromises as you start to solve harder and harder problems.
How do you check that?
Well, so there. For burn-in, I guess you can look at what the distributions look like. So if you plotted like the first 200 samples here, you would find that they fill a very, if you made a histogram of them, that histogram would be very different from the remainder of the chain.
So
if you say made a histogram of like where the first 200 samples are versus where the remaining samples are, you would find that those let's do it. Say if you made like a 2D histogram of like up to sample 250, you would find that that's quite different than you would find that histogram is quite different than the histogram of the remaining samples. You know, as you can see from this, from where the particles are, you know, we started out down here and then sort of never went back to that place. Sorry, I just had to rerun the notebook because it's computer restarted. okay. All right, there's that. All right. Oh yeah, what histogram? Well, so I mean, in practice, I would probably just basically eyeball the plot and say, oh yeah, okay, up to 500. But yeah, if you were going to make a histogram, I would look at like, so here on the chain is our whole list of, so it's our it's a matrix of number of steps by parameters. So here I have a histogram. So this is basically the first 200 samples of B versus the first 250 samples of M. So it's sort of, I think we started it out down here, maybe. Sort of climbs up that way. And then I think if you and then let's see if you, so if you histogrammed the samples after that point, you'd find that they are distributed quite differently. I don't know how to set the limits of the histograms to be the same. I think it might be X lim. Set it to like minus 50 and 150. Yeah, okay. And then we want the Y limits to be the same too. 1, 3. So these were the first 250 samples, and then these were the subsequent however many thousand samples. Okay. And if we plot it in this 2D position, you can see the same sort of thing. We initialized it here at some kind of value chosen out of the air, and it kind of fairly quickly found the peak of the distribution and then kind of spent the rest of its time roaming around. Okay. That was the lucky. I'm just going to run us this with a slightly longer chain, and then here I was showing how basically if you take the take the chain and histogram its values, so these are the values we get out of MCMC for that slope parameter. They match basically exactly the results you would predict from the least squares solution. So you know the MCMC solution is actually converging to the right answer. Those two curves aren't the same height because I don't know how to find to get the bin sizes of the histogram. And in order to get the things to come out the same height, you need to know the bin sizes of the histogram. So my knowledge of Julia is failing me in this case.
So would you calculate the density from the bin width and the number of samples?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, say it again? You compute the density.
The number of columns in the bin size. You cannot use the bin width, then you can get the density, and that's then the physical parameter.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Can you tell histogram to do that?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Divide something by the bin width or something.
Yeah, okay. I didn't find out how to get the bin width from the returned histogram. I've spent a lot of time training Google for how to do things with plots in Julia lately. It's been very learning. Okay. So then basically at this point in the notebook, it goes into a set of like things you can play with this algorithm. So the first one was thinking about these jump sizes that we had to set and how those are a pain. So here I was looking at trying a couple of different jump sizes and then basically just plotting how the particle moves around in the space. So I'll just show you that. I'm just going to roll up to look at that. So the first one was the jump we had before, and the second one was if we make the jump 3 times larger. So this is with kind of reasonable size jumps, and this is with larger size jumps. And what you see is this effect where it's flat for a lot of the time, and then jumps, and then it's flat again, and has a long series where the particle's not moving. And that's basically because the proposal is to move a long way in parameter space. So if you're, which means that if you're kind of along, oh yeah, sure. If you're along this ridge of fairly high probability, if you're anywhere here and you make a big jump, then you tend to go somewhere bad. Whereas if you make a more modest jump, then even if you go downhill, you don't go downhill too much, so you can sometimes still accept that move. So as you set the jump size larger, you end up with this effect that all of these times, it's basically proposed to take a jump in some poor direction. And all of those proposed jumps get rejected, so then the particle just ends up staying in the same place for a long time. And the result of that, so there are two things that comes out in this metric of the acceptance ratio that we were looking at. So if you count how often a jump is accepted versus rejected, that's called the acceptance rate. And when things are working smoothly, you want it to be like sort of around a half or between like 0.2 to 0.5, something like that. So in the second case, our acceptance rate was down to 8%. So that meant that almost all of, like 92% of the time, we were proposing a move that was too far and was just, as a result, in a poor part of the parameter space. So that means basically just that it takes a lot longer to effectively explore because these 50 samples are really just one sample. So it's one of the pains of this simple MCMC algorithm is having to set these jump sizes. In today's notebook, there's a little tweak on this algorithm. Because one of the pains here was that we have two parameters to set, two jump sizes, but only one metric back. Tells us whether it's sort of too big or too small. We don't know which of those two jumps we should change. Like, are we jumping too far in the M direction or too far in the B direction? So in today's notebook, there's a tweak on this algorithm where we, instead of jumping in both parameters simultaneously, we choose one randomly, jump in that direction, and measure the acceptance rates independently. So then that at least lets you tune those jumps one at a time rather than have like sort of guess which one is the wrong size. So that's a kind of like a little improvement on that state of being. But it remains a bit of an annoyance. Actually, in today's notebook, there's another really cute algorithm called the Ensemble Sampler. I'll tell you about a little bit later that solves some of these problems as well, the problem of having to specify jump sizes. But I'll tell you about that a little bit later. Okay. So that was basically question number three we were just talking about. And the variation on our MCMC algorithm allowing us to tune the jump sizes is called Gibbs sampler that is in today's notebook. So question four here is about one step in the MCMC algorithm that always seems a little bit surprising, which is that as we're going along, we take a jump, decide whether to keep it or not. And if we reject the jump and keep our old position, we end up storing another copy of that old position in the chain and returning it. And that seems surprising. Like, it seems like that we don't get anything out of that. But that's actually required for to satisfy the theoretical guarantees of MCMC that you do that. And if you, so if you try saying, if you say to yourself, that just doesn't seem right, I don't like that, I'm going to change the algorithm and not do that step, then it breaks it. And this question was to say, to try to convince yourself that it breaks it and see how and whether you would see it or not and what it does. So feel free to play with that if you want, but don't feel like you have to.
So you said that we cannot take all the samples because they are strongly correlated. So then if you keep the same sample, it will always be correlated with itself.
Yeah, that's right.
So eventually you'll get rid of the sample, right?
Yeah. yes, right.
So I understand what...
Yeah, so the question is basically... and in practice here, a thing that you will often see done is you will say run for 1,000 steps or something, and then decide that you're only going to keep every 10th sample. So it's called thinning the chain. Imagine you have your chain, you can take a thinned version of it, going from one by steps of 10 to the end, right? If you didn't save all of the copies, then this would sort of subsample them incorrectly, because when you propose a jump and reject it, that tells you something about where you are. It tells you that you're in a relatively good part of the parameter space, right? So as a result, for the distribution to come out right, you have to keep that copy. So it's sort of, it's basically like up, that sample should get upweighted. And the only way we have currently of upweighting them is to just to store another copy in the chain. And in practice, people will try to measure, instead of hard coding some value, they'll try to measure the correlation time, or measure the autocorrelation time of the samples, and use that to choose, how many subsamples, right? How much to subsample the chain to have sort of, kind of independent samples. So question five was about, we're doing this jump in the two parameters independently by drawing two Gaussian random numbers and just, essentially jumping in the two dimensions independently. But we know that our parameters are covariant, so... if you wanted, you could try using a better proposal distribution that knows about that covariance. So how you would put that in, I don't know exactly. You could maybe give a covariance matrix or something that had an estimate of what the covariance between the parameters was. In practice, that's a little bit of a pain to do. Okay, why don't I, should I take a round of questions, and then we can like flip over to today's notebook or further things to think about or discuss here.
I don't know.
I don't know what to do. Okay, I'm going to skip over to today. And it turns out that today's doesn't actually have any places where you have to fill in code. It's more of the things are more just exploratory today. So our data set as before, and today is all about using the foreground background model again. And I talked about but didn't show last time this probability terrain. If you hold the, in the foreground background model, if you hold the background model fixed, so if you nail pbad down at point one and nail down the distribution of the bad points, then this is what you end up getting for the foreground for the BNM components. And it's kind of funny because it has this core that we've seen before, but then the tails end up splitting into different tails that I think correspond to fitting different subsets of the points. So I guess it's sort of like as you move to different intercepts and slope, you sort of clip some of the points or not, and those end up giving you these little like strange tails. And when we were just using an optimizer, and there's actually one up here that's really hard to see, when we were just using the optimizer to find peaks in this space, if we initialized it here, it would climb up to the peak of that little local distribution and not know anything about that. Whereas our CMC algorithm will be able to find that. So one thing is that this was a log likelihood map, but if you look at the actual likelihood, like not log, then it actually is, you know, the peak is actually pretty pronounced and really holds most of the probability mass. Okay, so here's the MCMC algorithm from last time. And so the first thing was just to try running it with our foreground background model, take 1,000 steps and see what it does. I just eyeballed some parameters for the jump sizes. And the acceptance rate comes out at 30%, so that's good enough. So if we look at what the tracks in all of the parameters are, is what we get, right? So you can sort of see, like as before, see this sort of oscillating behavior for the M's and B's. Pbad seems to have this overall trend that it's, if I looked at that, I might say, well, maybe this chain isn't converged yet, but it still looks like that hasn't really, looks like it's still sort of changing over time. So I should probably run this for a little bit longer. Similarly, these background parameterizations are still moving around a bit. So it looks like for this, 1,000 steps isn't quite enough. And then, you know, I posed the question, said, oh, the acceptance rate is a little low. Which jump size should we change? In the vanilla MCMC algorithm, since you change all the parameters at once, it's hard to know which one to change. So I wrote this little variant called Gibbs that I'm going to use the hockey stick. That so saw as before, we pass in our log prob function, our initial guess, jump sizes, the number of steps we want to take. And now, instead of jumping them all at once, we're going to choose, each time through the loop, we're going to choose one of the parameters to adjust and just move in that single parameter. So we're just going to update the one element of that array and then compute the log prob there and accept as before. And now, instead of just computing an acceptance rate for the whole thing, we can compute an acceptance rate for just that one parameter. So then we can pass in our jump sizes and get out for each parameter what the acceptance rate is for jumping in that parameter with its with a jump that size. So it's pretty convenient. and I believe this preserves detailed balance, so still actually works correctly. So if you play around with, if you run that, here's, I think those are the acceptance rates I used before. And the rates for the different parameters are like, you know, 0.6, 0.3, 0.94, 0.96, 0.99. So the third one for sure seems like it's, like the jump is not big enough.
Why the third one?
Sorry, the last one. Actually, all three, like the latter three, really. So I might try doubling it. So that was a 9.4, and if I double it, it's still at 9.4. If I triple it, it goes down to 9.93. I think I'm only doing 1,000 steps here. I'm going to do a little bit more, because it runs almost instantly anyway. Oh, but then the other thing is, those parameters are a little bit tied together, so I'll try increasing the last one a little bit. So basically, I'm just like sort of messing around with these different step sizes to try to get behavior that, to get acceptance rates that are more in line with what I'm looking for, which is like maybe 80% or something like that. That one's a little low. So, you know, it's a fine art, guessing and testing. Okay, so then if we run with, after having messed around with the parameters a little bit, we get traces that look like this. This is 10,000 steps. And you can kind of, you can see the sort of oscillating behavior in B and M, where it looks like they're really kind of exploring the space pretty well. PBAD is also sort of doing that, even with the occasional excursions up to pretty high values for the background. And yeah, similarly, you know, these parameters are getting round a bit. So I'd be fairly happy with that, I think, if I were looking at samples. and we can take the parameters. Sorry, that was six. Oh yeah, we can take those jump sizes and feed them back into our vanilla MCMC if we so chose. But then really at the end of the day, what we care about is what are our actual M and B parameters and how well they fit the data. So if you want to If you want to do that, what you can do is basically just is take your chain and randomly draw 10 or 20 or 30 samples, ignore the burn-in part, and then take each of those samples and plot what it predicts about the foreground model. So these black lines are each draws from that chain. So those are all bits that are consistent with this data set. And there's a data point here that's buried under the bundle of fits. So the way that one always gets data point through it. And then this cluster constrains it pretty well. And then these ones basically always end up being more or less ignored by the fitting and outliers.
So remember you said you store the chain even the stuff that you reject?
Yeah. Oh, you don't store the ones that get rejected. But when you reject jump, you keep that old place where you were.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. And then, if you take. So, next I thought I would try to make one of those corner plots that you see in papers from time to time that show the distribution of all the parameters against all the other parameters. And I have to say, it didn't go very well for me and Julia. I tried a lot of different attempts, a lot of different approaches, and I couldn't get anything that looked very much better than this, which is pretty bad. So,
are these cuts to the 5D space?
So these are, sorry, I'm just going to try to get them all on screen at once. So these are the five parameters that we were working with. So these are the B and M parameters that we actually care about, and then this PBAD parameter saying how likely we think data points are to be bad versus good. And these are the capital Y and V that are the background distribution parameters, so the mean and variance. So the ones on the diagonal are one-dimensional histograms, so just projecting out that single dimension. And then the ones off diagonal are the 2D projection. So this one is that dimension versus that dimension, right? So showing that strong covariance we've seen all along, and basically if you take these points and project them up, they give you that. And if you turned this one sideways and projected these ones that way, they would give you that one. Or if you project these ones down, that.
So that means M and B are correlated?
Yeah, so it means M and B are strongly anti-correlated, yeah. This one looks, this is the PBAD, so this doesn't look too bad, really. Like, it doesn't look like it has a strong covariance with the parameters we care about.
How are these images scaled? Are they all scaled the same way? Or are they?
They're
squished and expanded.
The limits are the same. Yeah, the axis limits are the same. I did figure out how to do that. I believe the projections worked correctly. Like, that is actually in line with the peak and so on. Yeah, so I couldn't figure out how to make any of the cells just be absolutely empty. I tried turning off the axes and turning off the labels and turning off the frames and turning, I couldn't find the magical thing you have to turn off to make it not draw those two lines. and you know, ideally you would have labels on only the leftmost and the bottommost ones. But alas, I could not, I didn't try to figure out how to do that. So I guess that's an exercise left for the student. but good luck, because it seems really difficult. What's that?
Please don't forget to discuss projects that students want to do.
Yes, indeed. Yes, right. Okay, maybe I should actually do that right now. So could you remind me who is taking it for credit? Who are the... Okay, great. Maybe I'll just come around to you. Turn off the mic.
So, Dustin, before you
yeah.
can I ask you, so I don't know when we're supposed to work on this. Is it now time for us to...
I guess so. Yeah, sure.
This is the last.
Yeah, this is
now.
The last,
okay,
and then
so
you're done with me.
So, next week it will be unrelated to this, right?
Yeah, that's right. Next week is Luis, right?
We'll be teaching differential equations, PDEs, next week.
Okay. So can we arrange it so that we really have these 2 hours to, you know, work on this, as opposed to just following?
That's up to Dustin.
This is not enough. I'm not saying with Luis. Can we Fridays?
You want for Luis the Fridays
to actually work
directly?
Yeah. To, well,
yes.
And, you know, ask questions and make
yes, yes.
We're supposed to just, you know, going through all.
I will mention this to Luis as a strong suggestion.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. And also to the next one.
Ha 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 ha.